Hey, podcast listeners. Just a quick word before the show to tell you about our sponsor. Soonish is supported by Kent Rasmussen Winery of California. Rasmussen has been famous since 1986 for their purely poetic Pinot Noir, grown in the cool mists of the Carneros region of Napa Valley. And under the Companion Ramsey label, they offer superior quality North Coast Pinot Noir, Merlot, Petite Syrah, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Chardonnay at a wonderful price. I'm a longtime fan of these finely made wines. So, take a bottle of Rasmussen or Ramsey to your next dinner party, and you'll be sure to impress. For more information, visit KentRasmussenWinery.com. Okay, let's start the show. I'm Wade Rausch, and this is Soonish. It's a show about the future, how we think about it, what we can do to shape it, and why our best forecasts and our worst fears are usually wrong. A few weeks ago, I had my friend Graham Ramsey over for dinner. You might recognize Graham's name from the credits for Soonish. He's the composer who wrote the show's opening theme. Anyway, Graham opened a nice bottle of wine, and he sat down to watch while I started cooking.
So what are you chopping up there, Wade?
This is a giant green bell pepper. I'm just making a totally generic stir-fry.
Well, what's in a generic stir-fry?
In this case, carrots, green bell peppers, mushrooms, broccoli, and Beyond Chicken.
What is Beyond Chicken, pray tell?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I'm going to read the ingredient list. Water, soy protein isolate, pea protein isolate, chicken flavor, parentheses, yeast extract, potato maltodextrin, natural flavoring, salt, sunflower oil, citric acid, cloves, parentheses, rice flour, expeller processed canola oil, soy fiber, and carrot fiber.
Okay, so this is not chicken.
Not by a mile.
Okay. What's up next?
I'm starting the stir-fry. I'm now putting in the chicken, the faux chicken. And that means the rice is done. Turning off the rice, and I'm adding a dash of sriracha sauce.
Cheers. Here's to editing and to our chef. It's nice. It's a nice wine. There we go. And now I'm serving up the stir fry.
The creation.
And it looks pretty-ish. So what's interesting to me is we go through all this process and we're calling it faux chicken or beyond chicken or something, which is curious because, in fact, there's no chicken here. And why, if we are producing a vegetarian food, do we even need to address it as beef or chicken or fish or anything? There's this sort of implication that we're having to do the second best thing, right?
All right, so what do you think?
I don't know. I haven't tried it yet. I've been busy talking. Well, it's good on its own merits. I don't think I would ever mistake it for chicken.
I would say that this aspires to play the role of meat in the mix of textures you expect from a stir fry.
The flavor's okay. The texture is acceptable, not terrible, not chicken.
It's not chicken, but it's tasty, and it's perfectly good as sort of a protein substance for this stir fry.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, would a carnivore complain if you gave them this instead of a real chicken stir fry?
If you are advertising it as a substitution for chicken, yes. It really should be defined on its own terms. That's my feeling on it.
Okay. Well, this has been good. Thank you for putting up with all this.
Thank you for putting up with all my very pointed and, I'm sure, slightly annoying questions.
That's why I invited you over.
Because I'm annoying?
Yeah, no. Because you're good at asking slightly annoying questions.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for making me dinner. It's lovely.
Beyond Chicken comes from a company in El Segundo, California, called Beyond Meat. researchers there have also come up with a Beyond Burger that's made from plants, but looks, cooks, and tastes sort of like ground beef, complete with fake blood made from beets. A competing startup called Impossible Foods has a product they call the Impossible Burger, where the special ingredient is actual heme. Their heme comes from plants, but it's the same molecule that gives real red meat its pink color and slightly bloody taste. You can actually buy these simulated meat products in restaurants and grocery stores. And to me, that's a sign that we're finally getting serious about meat as a kind of technology. And we're asking whether the way we get our protein in the future might be different from the way we've gotten it in the past.
Hydrate level 4, please.
Ooh. Is it ready?
Here you go.
Oh boy, Mom, you sure can hydrate a pizza.
That's the scene in Back to the Future Part 2, where Marty McFly's mom uses a futuristic Black & Decker hydrator to turn a 2-inch freeze-dried pizza into a full steaming pie. And it's an example of this long tradition in science fiction, where every time we see a future food, it's presented in a way that's either funny or kind of disgusting. You can also think of examples like the blue bantha milk that Aunt Beru served in Star Wars Episode 4, or the liquefied fish and mashed carrots that astronauts sucked out of boxes in 2001: A Space Odyssey. Then, of course, there's Soylent Green, the 1973 movie where it turns out that the main ingredient in the eponymous protein wafers is human bodies. But here, in the actual present, we've got new products like Beyond Chicken and the Impossible Burger that offer tasty alternatives to meat from animals. And that means we might finally have to outgrow our old instinct to either laugh or wrinkle our noses. There are a lot of arguments for getting serious about alternative protein sources. Some of these arguments are about ethics. It would be nice if we didn't have to kill as many animals to get all the protein we need. And some of them are about nutrition. People like Michael Pollan say that diets emphasizing plant-based foods are simply healthier. The biggest argument of all may be the environmental one. A while back, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization looked at how raising livestock like cattle, pigs, and chickens contributes to global warming. They counted up all the carbon dioxide released by deforestation and feed production and farm transportation. They added in the methane released by belching cows and decaying manure. And they found that meat production is responsible for a whopping 18% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So, it would probably be smart if we started growing protein in ways that slow global warming instead of accelerating it. That's one reason why the work Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods are doing is so important. But then there's the challenge of getting consumers to actually buy alternative protein products. And so far, it seems like the main strategy for doing that has been to try to make products that simulate real meat. My little dinner experiment with my friend Graham was totally unscientific, but I do think it points to one of the risks in the simulation approach. The more a company claims that its plant-based products are just like meat, the more they're inviting consumers to judge them on that exact basis, and the more likely it is that they'll fail and get stuck in the so-called uncanny valley, where a simulation is just good enough to be disturbing. In today's episode, we're going to start from one simple idea. On a planet that'll probably be home to 10 billion people by 2050, we're going to have to think about replacing a lot of the meat we get from livestock with something else. We'll look closely at where food technology is going and what that something else might be. And we'll talk to people who are starting to think about better ways to package and promote alternative proteins. One approach to marketing meat substitutes is to back away from the simulation idea and let the product speak for itself. That's the strategy of a startup called the Jackfruit Company.
Basically, on my first day in India, I saw this huge green spiky thing on the street and thought it was an Indian porcupine. I tasted it, thought it was the best thing I'd ever tasted, started researching it.
This is Annie Ryu. Back in 2011, she was a pre-med student at Harvard College, and she was in India working on a healthcare project designed to get more pregnant women to come in for prenatal checkups. Then she discovered jackfruit. It's familiar to people in South Asia, but until recently, it was unknown to mainstream U.S. consumers.
Jackfruit has been used as a meat alternative in India for hundreds, if not thousands of years, because it naturally has this very meaty texture. It has texture of like meat sinews, but that's just from the natural high fiber content of the fruit.
Jack trees grow all over South and Southeast Asia, and they produce this enormous fruit that can swell up to 80 pounds. But Annie says she was surprised to find out that there wasn't really a system in India for harvesting jackfruit and getting it to market.
A single jackfruit tree can bear 2 to 3 tons of fruit every year without any maintenance. So, I mean, when it's rural India and you don't have good supply chains, good refrigeration, good storage, and you have the world's biggest fruit, you eat as much as you can, you give away as much as you can, and the vast majority of it rots on the ground.
Annie says she fell in love with the taste and the meat-like texture of jackfruit. She figured that if she could come up with a way to preserve it and package it, people in America would like it too. So she started the Jackfruit Company. And today, 6 years later, the Boulder, Colorado-based company sells its jackfruit blends in hundreds of stores around the U.S. They come in barbecue flavor, curry flavor, sesame ginger, and Tex-Mex. I've tried all four varieties, and I have to tell you, they are amazingly good. And the fruit's substantial enough that it can take the place of meat in a sloppy joe or a stir fry. Being a fruit, it doesn't have as much protein as meat, but what it does have is a ton of fiber. And that means it's filling without having lots of calories.
So it's the fiber that is giving you that satisfying mouthfeel and texture and eating experience, and it also fills you up because it's fiber. And so jackfruit, in being high in fiber, is also low in calories. So you can eat, heaping barbecue sandwich, like a jackfruit barbecue sandwich, and not feel like, wow, I need to go to sleep now, but actually feel like you just ate a healthy meal because you did.
Annie says she likes being in the jackfruit business because she can help farmers and the environment at the same time.
So the main positive impact for the farmers is in the fact that rather than having this fruit just go to waste, they're able to sell it to us and then add this like a tremendous additional environmental component when you're talking about replacing meat with something that is growing on trees. So not only do you not have to kill an animal to eat it, you actually are compelled to plant trees. If you run out, you plant more trees, and that's just helping the planet.
And Annie is doing all of this without trying to convince anyone that jackfruit tastes just like chicken or beef.
So what Annie's doing at the Jackfruit Company is, she was really kind of at the beginning of all this. She kind of could sense that there was an opening in this market long before it was clear that there was. And she's really been on the leading edge of helping to educate consumers about jackfruit.
This is Adam Salamon. He's an investor in food technology companies and the director of the Food Loft, a collaborative workspace for food and technology companies in Boston.
Again, 4 and 5 years ago, I think a lot of people would scratch their heads when talking about jackfruit and not know what it was. And now you're starting to see, again, it's showing up in retail environments. You're seeing recipes for it online. You're seeing it in much more of a broader context. I still think there's a way to go in terms of getting people actually using it more fully, but she's certainly on her way, and it provides a template for some of these other alternative products.
But what she's doing in choosing not to maybe emphasize that, hey, this is an alternative to meat,
yeah,
she's trying to sell it for itself.
Yes, exactly.
That could provide the template that you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. I think so, because she's not saying that it's anything other than jackfruit. And so I think that that's really a fascinating thing where you start to get at, what are these products? What are we calling them? How are we marketing them? And what Annie's done is decided that like jackfruit is a product that can stand on its own, which I think is potentially instructive as some of these other products really go out to market.
Now let's leave aside fruits and vegetables and talk about another possible future protein source that can't be passed off as anything other than what it is. And that's crickets. One day last fall, I traveled to San Leandro, California, to meet up with an entrepreneur who's become a caretaker to tens of millions of tropical house crickets.
Yeah, my name's Daniel Imrizitanaika. I'm CEO of Tiny Farms. And depending on what day it is, I could be digging around in cricket poop, feeding animals, developing computer vision software for counting insects, or pitching to investors.
Daniel Imrizitanaika started Tiny Farms in 2012 because he realized that the world doesn't really have a great way to raise crickets or other insects at high volume and low cost. It would be useful if we could, because it turns out that insects are really great at converting feed into protein.
There are so many uncharted and unmapped potential industries that are locked away inside of the biodiversity of insects that we think can be unleashed with the type of technology that we have today.
One of the main ones being food, right? Insects as a protein source.
Yeah, so when we talk about insects in food, it can either mean direct human consumption, which is exciting and trendy and fun, but still relatively early in the West. The other part where insects can play a role in our food chain is in producing feed. So we look at crickets, for example, as a perfect drop-in replacement for aquaculture feed.
Tiny Farms rents part of a former automobile factory in San Leandro, where it's testing an automated system for feeding and watering huge numbers of crickets. Daniel showed me around.
So we're standing outside our farm, which is in about a 2,000 square foot warehouse space with some very noisy construction going on underneath it. The farm's essentially an outer space and an inner space, and the outer space is where we do all the inventory and cleaning and stocking stuff. The inner space is where the crickets live, and it's essentially a freestanding structure that's kept at about 90 degrees at all times. Humidity is about 40 to 50%, so it's fairly hot in there. I guess like the first thing to do will be go through our sort of airlock here.
Okay.
Which is part of our mechanism to keep the crickets in. And
so, oh wow, it's a lot hotter in here.
Before you step through there, basically all visitors we have wear these shoe covering.
It reminds me of putting out a bunny suit to go into a semiconductor fab.
Yeah, it's a lot about our farm is more reminiscent of high-tech stuff than of a farm, really. Mm-hmm. I think we have more in common with a server farm than a regular one at this point.
Daniel isn't kidding about this high-tech part. Some of the inner space at Tiny Farms is being used to study old-fashioned cricket farming, which amounts to big plastic bins full of cardboard egg cartons that provide a habitat for the crickets. But the rest of the space is devoted to an experimental system that's so cutting-edge that Daniel asked me not to describe its exact design.
The principles that we're going for, which any good cricket farmer should already know, is that the more crickets you can fit a square foot, the better, because you're saving on labor costs, you're saving on heating costs, climate control is expensive, cleaning up after crickets and managing their behavior is expensive, and you need equipment, so the less space you can use, the better.
Luckily, Daniel says crickets like living together at high density. If you can keep them fed and watered and keep the temperature and the humidity right, they're basically protein machines. For every 2 pounds of cricket food you put in, you get 1 pound of crickets out, and Daniel thinks the company can drive that feed conversion ratio even higher without making the farming process more labor intensive.
But if we're talking about displacing some meat consumption or providing low-cost food for people around the world who already eat insects, we're not going to be able to use labor intensive practices. So the system we've developed essentially strips out a lot of that labor cost by modifying the physical structure.
Tiny Farms is able to raise about 3,000 pounds of crickets every month. And once those crickets are harvested, they can be eaten plain or ground up as cricket flour for products like energy bars. And there are companies like Exo that are doing exactly that. One 60-gram apple cinnamon protein bar from Exo has about 10 grams of protein, and it's all from crickets. Now, it's important to note that a cricket flour protein bar ain't exactly vegan or vegetarian, the way Beyond Meat or jackfruit are. But that's not the point.
Yeah, I mean, insects are meat, basically. I don't think we have any particular reason to say otherwise. They're animals, and animals that we eat, we call meat. That means that they should be treated with the same kind of dignity and respect that we would hopefully expect our livestock to be treated with. Unfortunately, that isn't the case in livestock agriculture generally. Animals are treated in a way that if most consumers saw close up and personal, they might think twice about eating meat. We have the opportunity to do things differently here. On the one hand, it's because we're starting from scratch and we don't have to bake in this kind of inhumane treatment from the beginning. On the other hand, it's also because insects are naturally better suited to being raised in captivity. They, depending on the species obviously, can live together in close proximity without risk of disease. You don't need to fill them full of antibiotics to avoid problems. They don't psychologically suffer from being close together because many species are kind of naturally existing in large colonies. So a lot of these kind of issues we can help address. But I think the idea that insects are anything less than meat is a weird Western artifact and is not going to persist for that much longer.
Speaking for myself, when I went vegetarian 10 years ago, it was because of my ethical concern for animals. I figured I would never eat my dog, so why would I eat a cow? Now, call me a hypocrite, but I can't seem to manage the same level of angst about crickets and other insects. And there may be some science to back me up on that. Entomologists say insects just don't have the neurological substrate to support consciousness or emotions or feel pain. Still, I'm glad Tiny Farms is figuring out ways to treat insects with dignity. And it seems like a no-brainer, so to speak, that we'd want to harness this efficient protein source. In the process, maybe we can also get over our weird Western fear of eating bugs.
I've never really put much of a stake in that anyway. You know, I think it's like, if you ask 100 people whether they'd eat insects, like, a third of them will say yes. Those are the people that you want to sell your insect foods to. It's the same with anything. If you go and ask everybody whether they like shrimp or not, you probably come up with a similar number.
Daniel says his goal for Tiny Farms is to get much bigger, big enough to make its insect farming system available around the world.
We're going to be able to just reduce the price of the product, and that allows people to start eating them more regularly. It allows them to be used as a kind of staple dietary kind of keystone as opposed to an occasional snack, and the market's ready to go.
So you sound pretty optimistic.
Yeah, absolutely. We view it as an inevitability. Insects have to be part of our food system, because if you look at the facts, if you look that we're going to need in the developing world about a quarter more agricultural land than currently exists, or that people are going to be eating about 50% more meat by 2050, there is no solution to these questions that doesn't involve different ways of doing things. We need to be leaning on all of the alternative protein sources that we have. And if you look at the ones that actually are currently viable, those are things like soy, those are new generation high protein crops like quinoa, and that is insects.
There's one more alternative protein source that's farther off in the future than cricket flour, but might have a more natural appeal to American eaters, and that's actual meat that's been cultured in a lab rather than grown as part of an animal. Cellular agriculture is the science of growing in vitro meat, or cultured meat, and there's a nonprofit in New York City called New Harvest whose sole mission is to spread the word about cellular agriculture and support more R&D. One of the ways they're doing that is by creating fellowships for graduate students at major universities. And a few weeks ago, I went to Tufts University outside Boston to meet the very first recipient of a New Harvest Fellowship.
Yeah, so my name is Natalie Rubio. I'm originally from Boulder, Colorado. I did my bachelor's degree at the University of Colorado in Boulder in chemical and biological engineering.
At Tufts, Natalie is studying with a professor of biomedical engineering named David Kaplan, who's an expert on tissue engineering and biomaterials. She showed me a room in Kaplan's lab where she's trying to grow cells cultured from a turkey inside little plastic dishes.
So this is our cell culture room. Let me grab... So this is my incubator where we keep the cells so they're at the right temperature and CO2 concentration.
Is that roughly like body temperature?
Yeah, exactly. That's what they like to grow at. They don't like to grow at room temperature.
Okay, you're putting them on a stereo microscope. Oh, nice.
Is it focused well?
Yeah, it's focused.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see lots of fibrils going in all directions. So these are muscle cells?
We hope so. That's what they look like. We haven't done any characterization yet to make sure, but they look like what muscle cells should look like.
Do you want to sit down and just put in your own words what they look like?
So you noted that there's a lot of like long fibers that are going in all directions, but they kind of are aligned in some areas. The ones that are close to each other are going in the same direction. And as we allow them to grow, they will multiply and divide. And when they start to differentiate into muscle, they'll fuse together to form these really long tubes, which is what muscle should do.
Will they get to the point where they'll start to clump together and form visible pieces of tissue?
They're attached to this bottom of this plate right now. So So I think if we detached them and spun them down, you would be able to see a small pellet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It sounds like basically this is an exercise in figuring out whether it's possible to culture turkey muscle cells outside of a turkey.
And just keep them going. We want to expand them indefinitely. And if you don't culture them under the right conditions, they could just stop. They won't replicate anymore. And since we only want to use donor animals ideally once to get the original source of cells, eventually we want, you know, an immortalized cell line that will only have to, you know, take a vial of cells instead of going back to the animal and taking more biopsies.
The whole idea with cellular agriculture is to come to grips with the fact that a lot of people really like to eat meat. So the job becomes finding a way to grow meat that reduces the suffering of animals while also reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But Natalie says there are a bunch of big problems that still have to be solved before anyone can grow cultured meat on an industrial scale. One of them is this question of where you get the cells and how to make them immortal.
And this has been done with a lot of human cells and with mouse cells, things that are used as research models. But not a lot of people have immortalized muscle cell lines for domestic farm species, because why really would you unless it has some sort of medical benefit? So that is kind of one of the fundamental things that just needs to get done.
The next big question is where to grow the cells. The plastic dishes like the one from Natalie's incubator won't work because you can only use them to grow a single flat layer of cells. To make muscle tissue, you need to grow the cells at high density inside a larger vessel called a bioreactor. You need to create some kind of biodegradable scaffolding for the cells to grow on. And you need to keep them bathed in a growth medium. And ideally, that medium wouldn't come from cow fetuses like it does now.
I've thought about what I want to focus on a lot, and I think the best path forward is to work on the scaffolding, because I am in an area, the Kaplan Lab, that has such a great support system surrounding biomaterials. They're experts on biomaterials, which is what we build the scaffolds out of. So I'll have a lot of mentorship and people to give me the right advice.
I want to kind of ask a big question about why it's so important to create cultured meat that you can say is meat, as opposed to making a really, really good simulation of meat that's plant-based.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and I'm not 100% sold that, like, this is the way to do it and plant-based is not. My perspective is animal agriculture is such a huge, massive, impending problem that we need to come at it from all angles. We need so many people working on every possible type of solution as fast as possible so that we can kind of, you know, take away some of these negative impacts that are happening to our planet.
But Natalie says there are lots of good reasons to focus on cellular agriculture. And one of them is that some consumers are just never going to develop a taste for the plant-based alternatives like Beyond Chicken or the Impossible Burger.
And like sometimes people just want meat. Some people like meat. There are some connotations with vegetarianism and veganism that not everyone is drawn to. At this point, instead of, you know, convincing the market to come to us, we have to go to where the market is, because as I've seen, I've talked to a lot of people, we're not going to convince everyone to go vegan. As some people try one vegan alternative, they didn't like it, they won't try another one. That's another reason.
Yeah, I saw a poll that said that half of vegetarians would be willing to try a cultured meat. But I was more interested in the opposite, like how many carnivores would be willing to try cultured meat.
There's so many polls out there. I've seen ones that say between like 20 and 80%. It depends what kind of audience you're viewing. But I think that's where New Harvest comes in. If you just tell someone like, oh, this burger was grown in a lab, like that doesn't sound nice. And if people haven't heard of it before, they're probably going to say, no, that's gross. But every single person that I've sat down with that has had a negative, you know, perspective of it at the beginning, once I address all their concerns and, you know, tell them what it is, 100% of the people I've talked to have turned around and been like, yeah, that's a great idea. I would totally try that.
So you find it pretty easy to get people on board with this?
Yeah. One example I think of is my family, because they've been with me through the whole, journey of becoming a vegetarian. And, you know, I went through that phase where I was just trying to convince everyone around me to give up meat. and they did not respond to that. But then I found out about cultured meat, and, you know, as I talked to them about that, they thought it was weird. But as I stuck with it and learned more, and I would, you know, tell them everything I was learning, they've become, you know, my biggest supporters. And every one of them is like, yeah, I'd try that. I can't wait to, you know, try what you're making in your lab.
I can't wait to try it either. The fact is, I like meat. And there's no question that meat's a huge part of our history and our culture as a species. So I'd love it if technology helped me find a way back to the land of the carnivores. Maybe the road to that land leads through the uncanny valley of simulated meat. But I'm hoping it doesn't stop there. Zunish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. The show's theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. Additional music this week by Poddington Bear. March is Tripod Month. The hosts of hundreds of podcasts are coming together to encourage podcast listeners to introduce one friend, relative, or coworker to a new podcast and show them how to listen. We're also encouraging folks to share their favorite podcasts and stories about why they listen using the hashtag Tripod. That's #TRYPOD. My own recommendation for Tripod is an awesome show called Gastropod, made by my fellow podcasters Cynthia Graber and Nicola Twilley. It's all about food through the lens of science and history. In today's show, I didn't go very deeply into the ethical, nutritional, or environmental arguments for vegetarianism. But that's exactly what Cynthia and Nikki do in the February 14th, 2017 episode of Gastropod, which is called To Eat or Not to Eat Meat. So, you've got to check it out. Here at Soonish, our first season is off to a really strong start, and I'm so grateful to everyone who's become a regular listener. But I just know there are more people out there who would love the show if they knew about it, and I need your help to reach them. So, please, share Soonish on Twitter or Facebook this month using the Tripod hashtag. It also really helps when you leave a rating and a review at the iTunes store. If you've already done that, a huge thank you. It makes a big difference. Of course, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn, Radio Public, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow Soonish on Twitter at Soonish Podcast. And you can reach me with comments or episode ideas at info@soonishpodcast.org. Thanks this week to my guests Graham Ramsey, Annie Ryu, Adam Salamone, Daniel Imri Sitanayaka, and Natalie Rubio. You can learn more about all the people and ideas in this episode at the show's website, soonishpodcast.org, where you'll also find the music playlist for this episode and the full recording of my interview with Adam Salamone. On the website, you can also sign up for our email newsletter, Signals from Soonish, which includes exclusive details about the show and information about upcoming episodes. Soonish is a proud member at the PRX Podcast Garage, a community recording studio and workspace in Alston, Massachusetts. For more information, go to podcastgarage.org. Special thanks to our sponsor, Kent Rasmussen Winery, and their purely poetic Pinot Noir. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with a new episode soonish.
What would you like for breakfast?
The usual.
Milk, cereal,
and some bacon.
Bacon.
And one soft-boiled egg.
And one soft-boiled egg.
Thanks, Mom.